had asked me to record it as well. So, all right. So I try before each holiday to find something a little different, something a little bit out of the ordinary, something not, you know, a little off the beaten track. The same old, I think you guys have heard over the years. I don't need to review it with you. So this one's a little different. To really appreciate, and we're going to talk about Passover, we're going to talk about Pesach. And my goal tonight is to really impress upon you how packed, how potentially packed the night of the Seder is, and why it is really incumbent upon us to capitalize on what's available and to really focus and harness our power to draw from it what we can. That's really my goal. So I'm going to start with something very basic. I'm going to go back to a story that we're familiar with in the Torah. And honestly, this story is one of the most difficult stories in the Torah, and lots of questions about it, of which I don't have all the answers, but I think it's worthy of going through it. It's the famous story of where Isaac, already at his advanced age, who's blind, he's already an older man, his eyes were dimmed, he couldn't see properly, and he turns to his older son, Esau, and he says to him, I want you to go prepare my favorite foods. I want you to go out, hunt out in the field, make for me the delicacy that I love so that I can give you a blessing before I die. His wife, Isaac's wife, Rebecca, hears this and tells her son, Jacob, to go ahead and we're going to prepare all of this, and I want you to go in and get that blessing from Isaac. Without getting into the details of how could Jacob do it, how could Rebecca do it, how did he pull it off, those are all good questions, but I want to point out a couple of interesting things about it. And you'll see, I'm going to purposely leave out one critical piece of information, but you'll see it. What happens? The Torah tells us the following. Rebecca calls Jacob aside, and after Esau goes out into the field to go hunting, she says to her son Yaakov and says, I want you to go get this blessing. Yaakov puts up a fight. He puts up a concern, and he said, but my brother Esau is hairy. I'm smooth skinned. Dad's going to figure it out in no time. And instead of giving me a blessing, he's going to give me a curse that I'm trying to trick him. Don't worry, says Rebecca. I got this. Take some of Esau's clothing, very furry clothing, and puts them on Yaakov's skin so that he would pretend to be Esau. Listen to what the Torah says. The Torah says, with the skins of the goat kids, she covered his arms and his smooth-skinned neck. She placed the delicacies and the bread which she had made into the hand of her son, Jacob. Back up a couple of sentences here, sorry. So I want you to go, she says. So he went, he fetched and brought to his mother, and his mother made delicacies as his father loved. What do I want you to do, she says? Heed my voice to that which I command you. Go now to the flock and fetch me from there two choice young kids of the goats, meaning two young goats, and I will make of them the delicacies for your father as he loves. Then bring it to your father. He shall eat so that he may bless you before his death. She tells him to bring two goats. Okay, we go further along in the story. Jacob brings it. He says, Father, he says, here I am. Who are you, my son? He pretends to be Esau. Isaac is surprised because he's speaking. The voice sounds like Jacob, but the hairiness feels like Jacob, and he's confused. But at the end of the day, he gives him a blessing. But here's what it says. So he served him and he ate, and he brought him wine and he drank. Then his father Isaac said to him, come close and kiss me, my son. He drew close. He smelled the fragrance of his garments and he blessed him and he gave him the bracha there. Fine. Two very interesting pieces of information are being shared with us here. First of all, the fact that there's two goats, that's a pretty hefty meal for one older man. Why does Rivka feel the need to bring two goats? And number two is, did Isaac ever ask for wine? Did Rebecca even ever tell Jacob to bring wine? It doesn't seem to record that anywhere. Yet that is exactly what he gave him, and he drank. So the Zohar is bothered by this. The Zohar, the great book of mysticism, is bothered by this taking the two goats and the wine. And he fills in one critical piece of information that the text does not. When does this story take place, gentlemen? The Zohar tells us that it corresponds to the exact date on the calendar of Passover, the night of the Seder. The night of the Seder that we go ahead and we have our whole big shebang, that was the night in where Jacob brought the food to Isaac and Isaac gave him the blessings. And the Zohar brings two versions of why two goats. The first version has it as the two required offerings when the temple stood. We had to bring the Karban Pesach, the Pesach offering, as well as the regular Yom Tov offering known as the Chagigah. Two offerings that are required every holiday. The Chagigah is required, and obviously for Pesach, you have the unique Pesach one. That's one version. But then comes the absolute curveball. You ready for this, Irv? The Zohar says that two goats, you know what, I'm not even going to say it. As soon as I say the words two goats, what comes to your mind?
Yom Kippur.
Yes, yes. The two goats that are used in the famous Yom Kippur ceremony of the two goats, one that is brought as an offering to God and one that is sent out on a cliff and thrown over the cliff, the Sa'ir La'azazel. If you ever want to upset somebody in Israel and you want to tell them off, you tell them Lech La'azazel, which in English means go to hell, right? That's how you tell them, Lech La'azazel. Why? Because that's the corresponding story about this goat. The two goats. Jim, you know that story? The two goats that are brought on Yom Kippur. The Kohen Gadol puts his hand in a lottery, pulls out one in his right hand and one in his left. One says La Hashem, for God. That's going to be brought as an offering. And the other is La Zazel. Says the Zohar, this was referring to the two goats of Yom Kippur. And therefore, Rebecca wanted to bring before Isaac the two goats. Okay, interesting, but what are we supposed to make of this? Well, let's take it one step further. Let's go back to the wine for a moment. Jacob brings wine to Isaac and he drinks it. It was never asked for by Isaac. Was never commanded by Rebecca, yet he brought it. If you learn like the first version of the Zohar, that this is referring to Passover night, then this might be an allusion to the four cups of wine that take place at the Seder again. But here's what's interesting. In the Torah itself, it does not ever say that you're supposed to be drinking wine at the Seder. There's no such command. Do you ever know that? It doesn't say in the Torah that you're required to drink four cups of wine. In fact, it's only at a rabbinic level at this point. Now without a temple where we're not even bringing the Pesach offering, the four cups of wine that we drink at the Seder are purely rabbinic. It's not a command, at least not on a biblical level. What we find, therefore, is that things that we do the night of the Seder are all going to play some kind of symbolism trying to mimic certain things that take place on Yom Kippur. And what I'm trying to do is to draw a parallel. The Seder night of Pesach matches Yom Kippur. That's how deeply rooted the potential for blessing is the night of the Seder. Howard, off the top of your head, are there things that we do at the Seder that are similar to things that take place on Yom Kippur that you can think of?
I'm at a blank.
Okay. Anybody? Things we do.
Go to shul.
Yes, we go to shul. Okay. How about uniquely for Pesach?
There's a fast before Pesach.
Okay, interesting. There's a fast. That's true. Right. For the firstborns, there's a fast. Very good. What else? What do we wear? Many people have the custom to wear something special at the Seder, or at least the leader of the Seder.
The tennis shoes or the kittel.
The kittel, not tennis shoes. Tennis shoes is Tisha B'Av, that's close. But the kittel. The kittel is the white robe, you know, without the hood. Sorry. Okay, just to clarify. Not like those guys with the hood. The other white robe. The kittel. Wow, very similar to what is worn on Yom Kippur. We wear the kittel, right? Many people have that custom. We wear it. Why? Because again, who wore white clothing on Yom Kippur?
Kohen Gadol.
The Kohen Gadol, the high priest, when he served and did all of the ceremonies involved in Yom Kippur, especially when he went into the Holy of Holies, he had to wear white. He had to wear white clothing. Typically, many people don't know this, but typically on a regular Tuesday, if the Kohen Gadol, if the high priest wants to do a service, he wore special, ornate, mostly gold clothing. However, the Talmud learns out that he was forbidden to wear gold clothing when he went into the inner sanctum, the Holy of Holies. Why? Because it was somewhat of a reminder of a terrible tragedy in Jewish history, the sin of the golden calf. So when he went into the Holy of Holies, the absolute holiest site in the universe, he was not allowed to wear gold, and he wore white linen clothing, similar to the kittel that we wear on Yom Kippur. That is what we wear at the Seder. Because again, we, in the service of the Seder, are going to be acting with many aspects of it, similar to what goes on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Let's talk about this for a moment. Let's take it even further. Why the color white? Tell me about the color white.
Represent purity.
Yeah.
Good. On the first level, absolutely true. And that is, it represents purity. We wear it on Yom Kippur because we are seeking forgiveness and starting fresh, becoming purified in the process. So we wear white. That's true. Similarly, on the night of the Seder, which we'll see in a moment. But tell me about the color of white. Like what aspect of it in terms of its color?
It has all the colors.
Okay, very good. It's really not a color. It really is reflecting all the other colors. That's why the way to see the rainbow in a prism, when you shine light through it, it's the white light that contains within it all the other lights. So it contains, it's almost as if, like I said, on Yom Kippur, the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, is removed and representing all of the Jewish people at that moment. The entire spectrum, from green and red and yellow and blue, everywhere along the spectrum, Jews are represented by the Kohen Gadol wearing white. Okay? Here's another interesting thing. most, I did not know this. I saw this brought down in a Sefer, that there is a custom some people have of right before the youngest child reads the Manishtana, or if there's no child, obviously anybody will read the Manishtana. There's a custom to clap your hands. Anyone hear that custom before? Me neither. I just came across it not that long ago, that there's a custom to clap before Manishtana. Why? What's the symbolism there? So again, we refer back to the Kohen Gadol. One of the articles of clothing that the Kohen Gadol wore was a robe of sort that at the bottom, what was at the bottom, gentlemen? Anybody?
Bells.
Bells. That's right. Bells and pomegranates, little designed things at the hem of his robe, but it made noise. The pasuk actually says, "V'nishma kolo bivo'o el hakodesh." You would hear him coming as he was approaching the holy of holies. You would hear it. So in a sense, we're going to make noise that we are about to begin the main section of the Haggadah, Magid. So we are announcing our arrival, similar to the Kohen Gadol. What else do we do? Now think like a Kohen, think like a Kohen Gadol. You're serving in the temple. What else did you do?
Wash.
What?
Wash.
Wash. Very good. They used to wash. They would wash their hands. In fact, the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur, he would go through numerous washings, numerous immersions in water, because that's what he would do to prepare. We have the custom to wash our hands twice, like the Kohen Gadol, before each section of doing the service. The patterns continue throughout the entire night. And all of this would be fine, and I think would be wonderful to impress upon you that the blessings that we seek in our life, the key to those blessings are on the table for taking at the Seder. But I'm not happy just to end it there. I want to take it a step higher. I want to make sure everybody's on board. Everybody's with me here, following the concept that the night of the Seder is like Yom Kippur. But now let's take it a step further. I mentioned to you that on Yom Kippur, one of the fundamental ceremonies of Yom Kippur are those two goats. One that was brought LaHashem, one that was brought on the Mizbeach, on the altar as an offering for as part of the atonement. And the other was sent way out of Jerusalem to a very steep cliff, to an area known as Azazel, and it was thrown over the cliff, a very strange procedure, a very strange ceremony. Maybe we'll talk about it when we get closer to Yom Kippur. But what's up with that? It's a very strange thing. It almost seems, I hate to say it, right, but it seems very paganistic. Like you're going to throw a goat over to bring something for, well, I'm going to make matters worse for myself than better. The Zohar tells us that part of the rationale behind this is we're trying to bribe. We're trying to appease and bribe Satan so that he not be a prosecutor on the day of Yom Kippur. We're throwing him a bone. Now, wait. Before you jump on me, because it really doesn't sound very Jewish. Let's take a step back. I am not suggesting, nor am I even hinting, that there are two, heaven forbid, that there are two conflicting deities that are constantly struggling, good versus evil. There's a God of good and God of evil, and we just have to appease both of them. Heaven forbid, I am not saying anything of the sort. However, there is a concept in Judaism that for mankind to have free will, there needs to be two viable options from which I can choose. If it's such an obvious, a slam dunk, 99-1 kind of imbalance, then how much credit can I get for choosing to do good? the famous story of Pavlovian, you know, where he takes every time the dog does something good, it gets a positive reward. And every time it does something bad, it gets an electric shock. So of course, he's going to do the right thing. He's conditioned to do it. The animal is not making a free-willed choice because it's conditioned when it's a no-brainer. We can all be conditioned as robots. What God wants, however, is for us to have two viable options. Both seem to be good. Both seem to have benefit to mankind. The trick, the hard part, is to take a step back and say, what's truly beneficial for me in the long term? Right? They've done many, many studies of where they'll ask a young child, I'll give you, he puts a cupcake in front of him or a piece of candy and says, I'm going to step out for a minute. If you can hold yourself back and not eat the cupcake now, when I come back in a minute, I'll give you two cupcakes. And the child obviously is grappling because dad just stepped out of the room. There's a cupcake, a really good looking cupcake right in front of him, and he wants it. And I can have it right now. But if I hold off, children have a hard time with that concept. So do we, because we live for the here and now, unfortunately, and we forget that there's a bigger picture. That's part of the challenge of good versus evil. But my point being is that God allows for quote unquote evil to exist so that it's a viable option. Now, when you have two options, again, let's talk about the Yetzirah. Let's talk about this quote unquote evil inclination, the one that's trying to encourage you for the here and now, for the pleasures of this world, to forget the long term, just come on, right? That's the one who tries to convince you to just do what you want now, take the pleasures now. Is the Yetzirah a bad guy? The answer really is no. The answer is really no. This is his job. His job is to try to present to mankind the allure that it's a good option, right? For a child, again, using that as the analogy, for a child, the more bells and whistles you put on it, the more tempting it is to choose it. Even though something is better without it, it's plain, right? If you ever bought a car, you know that it may be wonderful to see the nice rims and the fancy headlights, right? But if you don't pick up the hood and see what the engine looks like, you're missing the boat. You're looking at the bells and whistles. Got to see what the real, what's the guts of it? So to have this, you have to have the illusion that there's good choices to be made by choosing evil. This is represented by the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, which the Talmud says is known also as Satan, different names that are used. On Yom Kippur, the Zohar tells us that we acknowledge and say, I have two goats. And you know about those goats? They are identical. They have to be purchased at the same time. They look the same. Their value is the same. They look like two identical options. One gets chosen Lashem. One gets chosen for God. And one gets chosen for Azazel. The one gets, if you were watching, you're an alien watching. You see the one that's taken for Hashem, what happens? The goat is taken, it's slaughtered, it's burnt on the altar, its blood is sprinkled. You're like, dude, I am so glad I didn't get chosen for that one. Meanwhile, you're looking at the one that's going to Azazel and you're like, man, that one's lucky. He's walking out of the temple. Woo! He's got it good. And he's walking further and further away from that barbaric. Oh my God. Oh, you can almost see the goat of Azazel just like wiping away the sweat. Man, I dodged a bullet there. And the next thing you know, he's thrown over the cliff. I mean, he didn't see that one coming. But if you think about it, that's what life of these two choices that we face every day. Yes. Is it hard? Does it seem more challenging for me to have to spend the amount of money for the same product that I could have bought 3 weeks ago before Purim? It was $1.59, same product, except it has one extra letter on it. Instead of it just being an OU, it says OUP, standing for kosher for Pesach. Instead of it being $1.99, it's $4.99. Can you explain it to me? I don't know either why that is. But that's the way you go. Sure, it looks like my giving up a day of work by keeping Shabbos, by my giving up by having to pay more for kosher, by my having to give up by having to purchase mezuzahs for my house and matzah for the Pesach Seder, and to have to give up. It sure seems like we're the goat that's going Lashem. It's an immediate sacrifice. It's so much easier to just walk down. Yeah, but that's not how it works. So therefore, this goat that is thrown over the cliff, Lazazel, is somewhat of a bribe to that other side and say, here, you know what? We acknowledge you exist. I'm not going to deny it. I know there are two options. Here, I'm going to throw you a bone. And I'm going to say, I get it. I recognize you exist also, not as God, not as a God, but you do exist and you act as an allure for me. There's a fascinating verse in Mishle, in Proverbs, that says, "Im ra'ev sonecha," if your enemy is hungry, "ha'achileu lechem," feed him bread. On the simple surface, it means that if you want somebody who is an enemy of yours to become a friend of yours, then you need to extend yourself. You need to go ahead and help them. Very often, it's totally an aside, but gentlemen, if you want to write down a great line, this is what you want to write down. People are under the assumption that you give to someone you love. It's true, but it's not the starting point. The starting point is the other way around. If you want to love someone, give to them. It's not the starting point as I love you, therefore I give to you. It's the other way around. Because I give to you, that nurtures, that creates love. The more I give of myself to you, the more I create that bond of love between us. And obviously, it's a great cycle, because the more I love you, the more I want to give. And the more I give, the more I love. And it's a great cycle. So that's what the Mishlei, that's what Proverbs says. If you have an enemy, someone who you don't get along with, who's hungry, you know what you should do? Feed them. Give them bread. We start our Seder right by Manishtana, right? Mm-hmm. Obviously, we make Kiddush. We have karpas, that unusual dipping of the vegetable. We split the middle matzah, right? But then when we get down to brass tacks, we start with a paragraph. Halach ma'anya, this is the poor man's bread that they used to eat in Egypt. You ever notice what language is that in?
Aramaic.
It's Aramaic. The whole Haggadah is in Hebrew, except for that opening paragraph. Lots of answers are given as to why, but it is worthy of note that that's a paragraph that's in Aramaic. And for an extra bonus, please tell me there's one other place in the Haggadah that we focus and say it in Aramaic.
Chad Gadya.
All right, way to go, Jordy. Chad Gadya. Some of you are long asleep by then, but it is the very last song at the end of the Seder. Chad Gadya, Chad Gadya. That one's also in Aramaic. What is going on? We start the Seder with it, we end the Seder with it, and everything in the middle is Hebrew. So Aramaic is called Arami, Aramis. That's the language, Arami. but it's the terminology. If you want to call somebody a trickster, someone who is a conniving, trying to trick you into doing something or not do something, they're called rama'i. It's called it a rama'i. That's the word that's used. So yes, we talk about it, a rami oved avi. In the Haggadah, we talk about the Aramean who tried to kill our ancestor, and it's referring to Uncle Laban, Lavan. However, on a deeper level, it's referring to the ultimate trickster, the Yetzirah, the Satan, the evil inclination, Satan. He is there, and he wants to blow the opportunity of the night. He doesn't want you to capitalize on what the Seder has to offer. So he's going to go speak up against you. He's going to go before God, and he's going to prosecute and say, you can't listen to these guys sitting at the Seder. Do you know what a bunch of shlemils and shlemazel these guys are? Seriously, you can't take their matzah service and their maror service. God, you can't take them seriously. So what do? We're going to throw him a bone. We're going to throw him a bone. God said, I want you to get rid of all chametz in your house. Get rid of all leavened bread. Get rid of anything that has the rising aspect to it. In the Talmud, it refers to all of those yeast products that rise as the Yetzirah. The Yetzirah is that symbol, chametz, I should say better, that chametz, the leavened bread, is a symbol of the Yetzirah. And what we do is we're going to throw a bone, so to say, and we're going to give this Satan a little bit of an acknowledgement. And I'm going to say, oh, you don't have to prosecute against us. You see, we're eating matzah. And you want to join us, you're welcome to join us. Tell me a little bit about this matzah. Oh, yes, matzah. That's what the Jews ate when they were enslaved and they were leaving. And you know what? It's been a couple of thousand years and we're still eating the matzah. We're really still in exile. Not much has changed, Mr. Satan. Don't waste your time going and prosecuting us before God. No. It's really not much has changed. We go ahead similarly to where the story is told about a king who wants to throw a big party. And he has a couple of dogs in the palace, and the dogs, they can smell all the delicacies that are being, and they're barking like crazy, right? And if he doesn't deal with them, they're just going to keep barking, and it's going to ruin the whole party. So what does the king do? He throws them a couple of bones. He throws them some bones. Do you know that there's a mitzvah in the Torah to give a special gift of meat to your dog? Do you know that?
No.
Yeah. It says very clearly.
I've heard that.
Yeah.
It's the only mitzvah for a pet, right? Or for an animal?
Well, it says specifically the dog, but I'll show you where's the context. The context is our story of the Exodus. The Torah tells us a very strange thing. As the Jews are leaving, you know, it's clear that what the Nazis did in the Holocaust was a calculated way of trying to cause fear and terror of all of those, unfortunately, that were there. And they had dogs, German shepherds, barking because it creates that fear, that tension. Says the Torah, an unusual piece of trivia. As the Jews are leaving, the Torah says, Lo yechratz kelev lishono. No dog barked. Doesn't say elephants didn't do their thing, donkeys didn't bray, birds didn't chirp. It says nothing of the sort. All it says is that dogs did not bark. As a reward for that, the Torah says, that if you have an animal, let's say you're slaughtering an animal, a kosher animal, and you see, as you examine it, as we have to do, that it has a certain internal defect. For example, it has a hole in the lung or a hole in the heart. So even though you properly slaughtered it, you're not allowed to eat that meat. That's why one of the reasons why kosher meat is more expensive is because it can't just be mass produced. It has to have visual inspection by a knowledgeable rabbi who knows these laws. So if it has one of those internal blemishes that are listed in the Code of Jewish Law, it becomes unfit to eat, even though it's technically a kosher animal. What should you do with it? The Torah says, La kelev tashlichun oso. Throw it to the dog. Give the dog the piece of meat because it's a reward that it didn't bark to cause terror as all of the Jews were leaving in the time of the Exodus. Lo yechratz kelev lishono. The dog didn't bark, didn't put forth its tongue. That's the terminology that's used.
Rabbi.
Yes.
I don't know if I missed it, but I kind of like want to go two steps back. Did you answer the question? Maybe I missed it. Why do we have Aramaic in the beginning and the end of the song?
I'm in the middle of getting there.
Oh, sorry. I apologize. That's what I didn't think I heard it. And I thought you jumped into a different.
It's a long thing. I'm almost there.
I'm sorry. No. Okay. Thank you.
So typically during the year, we throw the dog a bone by giving it the meat that we call trefa. You know, you've all heard the term trefe, right? It's trefe. Well, we use that term. It's a borrowed term. We use the word to mean anything not kosher. We call it trefe. It's not really true. Trefe really means you slaughtered the animal properly, but it has one of those internal defects that don't allow you to eat it. That's really the term trefe. But we use it colloquially as just, you know, anything you can't eat, we call trefe. But that's what we do, is we give it to the dog. However, on Pesach, I'm not suggesting that you give your dog matzah, but the dog is representative here of the one who wants to bark and create fear and terror, otherwise known as the Yetzirah and the Satan. He wants to bark. He wants the night of the Seder to go barking before God and saying, don't accept their Seder ceremony. They're a bunch of you-know-whats. Did they really prepare? Did anyone take the time to go to a class at late Sunday night, 9 o'clock? Oh, wait. Right? Other people who didn't join, right? They're the Seder. The dog, quote-unquote, wants to bark. So what do? Is we make sure that we have the mechanism by which to keep him quiet. What is that? That's the matzah. The matzah that we eat is what quiets the dog. Why is that? So allow me one more tiny piece. The Zohar says, somebody who eats matzah the night of Pesach, the general laws of judgment that normally apply on Rosh Hashanah do not apply to him. He gets a pass. Whoa, one second here. Nobody told me that when I was in Hebrew school. They just put the fear of the bejibis in me about Rosh Hashanah, and I gotta be nervous and worried. Whoa, if I eat matzah Pesach night, I don't have to worry about a harsh judgment? Dude, where do I sign up? At first glance, the Zohar seems to make no sense. Why is it that if I eat matzah the night of the Pesach Seder, I get a pass for judgment? Perhaps we have the beginnings of understanding why that is. If I can get the Satan to keep quiet and not prosecute, then God's judgment, right? If nobody presents, it's like I got a parking ticket. And I had to go. Thankfully, it was on Zoom. I dealt with it, right? For some of the people who were on that Zoom court case, they got away easy. Why? Because the officer never showed. The officer doesn't show. There's nobody prosecuting. You're done. So imagine Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur come, and there's no prosecutor. There's nobody speaking up and says, oh my gosh, you know what Tuchman did this year? Tuchman did A, B, and C. And you know what he didn't do, even worse, is that he blew them off. You know, there's this group Sunday night 2 weeks ago. He just blew them off. He wasn't in the mood. No, just kidding. Right? So, but if the prosecutor never shows up, there's no claim. There's no prosecution. You're good. Says the Zohar, if you focus properly on what matzah means and utilize the Seder as if it was your Yom Kippur, then you have no prosecutor. You just bought yourself a free ticket, a get-out-of-jail-free card. Who wouldn't kill for something like that? This is what's being offered to us. Now, it's interesting. In the Zohar, it calls matzah. It gives it an interesting name. It's called michla de'asvasa, which literally means food of healing. Healing food. Now, the first time I heard that, I laughed. Not out loud, but I giggled. Because I can think of every other terminology of what to call matzah and what it does to my digestive system. The last thing I would have called it was food that provides healing. But the Zohar refers to it that way. And I didn't understand it. But I'm beginning to understand it. And that is partaking of the matzah and partaking of what the Seder has is in effect not so much a physical healing. It's not healing of the body, but much more of a healing of the soul. We are getting our affairs in order. Again, if we are focused on the night of the Seder and treat it like Yom Kippur, the way we wear the kittel and the way we wash our hands and the custom of the clap and so many other aspects of Seder night, then we are partaking of, for all intents and purposes, a mid-year Yom Kippur. So of course it's going to buy me some good health. It's going to buy me a spiritual health. Ami, you asked a good question. Why do we begin and end the Seder with Aramaic? Because the Satan is the only angel that understands Aramaic. As a general rule, angels do not understand Aramaic. I don't know the meaning behind that, but that's what's brought down in the holy books. Angels do not. And that's why there are certain paragraphs that are part of our service that are in Aramaic that we don't say out loud. We don't want. But the Satan does understand it. Now, the first opening paragraph, we invite the Satan to partake of our Seder. But what's at the end in Chad Gadya, the other one that's in Aramaic, the very last sentence, the very last chorus, for those who don't remember what Chad Gadya is, it goes through in a very cryptic and symbolic way of different stages of our history. That's really what it's referring to. From the kid that's bought for two zuz and comes along the cat and devours and comes along the dog and comes along the stick and the fire, right? Until finally you have the shochet who takes the ox and kills the ox. Then comes the malach hamaves, the angel of death who kills the shochet. But the very last line, va'asa hakadosh baruch hu v'shachat l'malach hamaves, comes along God and shechts the Malach HaMaves, kills and destroys the Satan. The end of it all is going ahead and taking away the power, so to say, taking the tongue away from the Malach HaMaves, who's the same as the Satan, the same as the Yetzer Hara. The end will be he will cease to exist. He will no longer have a leg to stand on to prosecute the Jewish people. That's the ultimate end. So yes, Ami, we invite him to the Seder in the beginning, but through the entire process of going through the Haggadah and eating the matzah and partaking of the maror and the four cups of wine and speaking about the miracles of the plagues and blah, blah, blah. The end result is we remind the Satan, the end of the day, you lose. If we do what we're supposed to, you lose, buddy. And it ends in Aramaic so that he understands very clearly. The Yetzirah, your day of death is coming sooner than you think. Now,
very good.
That's the general picture. But if this doesn't blow your mind, I have one more piece. One more piece, and it's somewhat related. This is again, and maybe I shouldn't. Maybe I should go back to the basics if this is way above and it's late and you just were looking for something to share at your table. I apologize. But the name, what is the name of the Satan? He has an actual name. So I'm just going to spell it. I'm going to spell it. It's brought down that one shouldn't pronounce it. Because, you know, it's a root of evil and you don't want to even utter the words. But if you put the following letters together in Hebrew, that's its name. It's Samach and Mem, followed by an Aleph and a Lamed.
Never heard it.
For good reason.
Good.
So I'll just put a pause in between, but it's pronounced Sama. And then there's a break, El. That's the name. Samach Mem, and then Aleph Lamed. I'll just do it very briefly. There's a general concept. There's nothing, I think we spoke about this once. Everything that exists in our world has to have some element of sanctity, must have some positive energy. It has to. There's no such thing as completely evil to the point that it is disconnected from God. It can't exist. If God doesn't will it to exist, it cannot. So even something that is the epitome of evil must have within it some, even if it's minuscule, must have some little spark of holiness that keeps it connected to God. Similar to if you have any electronics, that if you unplug it and there's no battery, it ceases to function. As long as it's plugged in, even if it's off, it draws a little bit of current. That's why. So everything in our world has to have some tiny little element, at least, of connection to God. Even this angel, Samach Mem Aleph Lamed, the Arizal tells us that the first two letters of its name represent the impurity. That's the negative side. And the Aleph and Lamed represents, the Samach and the Mem is its impurity, and the Aleph and Lamed is its purity. You can understand that because Aleph Lamed is God's name, right?
Yeah.
Okay, you guys with me? Give me 3 minutes. 3 minutes, I'll put it all together. Okay. Let's just for a moment go back to the story of Noah and the flood. Okay? Noah, he builds this ark, and the Torah, for what seems to be an unexplicable reason, gives us the dimensions of this ark. Obviously, it was miraculous to get all the animals on board. So to go ahead and tell me that it was 300 cubits this way and 50 cubits this way and that, who cares? Like, it's still going to be a miracle no matter how you slice this. What is the big deal with this? So what does the Torah tell us? That generation, what they did that was the straw that broke the camel's back is that they committed something called chamas. I know in Hebrew, we call it Hamas. Hamas is this terrible terrorist organization. Gentlemen, there is absolutely positively, to the best of my knowledge, no connection to this Hebrew word Hamas. It's just interesting, okay? But the Torah says that they committed all the atrocities, but the straw that broke the camel's back is that they committed Hamas. Hamas was a form of theft, robbery, that they would commit this. Okay. Here's what I want you to do. If you take the letters of this angel, okay, and you have Samach and Mem on one side, because that's the impurity, and Aleph and Lamed on the other side, which is its connection to purity, connection to God. So then what happens when you go ahead and you and you have this ark that's supposed to be 300 cubits long, 50 cubits wide, 30 cubits tall, and then at the very top was one more cubit of which had a skylight window of some sort. What happens if you take these letters? It's crazy. And you take away from, you know, how do I put it? Let me just, 1 second. I want to make sure I get this right here. Hamas, 1 second. Hamas. Right. Okay. So you have these two words, Hamas, which is Ches, the letter Ches, and me, and what?
Shmone, Mem Zarbaim.
No, no, forget the numbers. Forget the just you have Ches, right? Which is the letter Ches. That's its, so to say, its impure side. But what happens is that you take these letters and you take away. I'm not saying it correctly. I'm sorry. Let's do it this way. Okay. You have the word nachash. Let's do it that way. The word is nachash. Nachash is a snake. Okay. The snake is the famous story in the Garden of Eden that represents evil. So in effect, I'm going to equate the Samach Mem Aleph Lamed to the word nachash. Nun Ches Shin. Okay, there's similarities, not the letters, but their functionality, what they stand for. The serpent, the snake in the Garden of Eden is representative of evil incarnate, as does the Samach Mem Aleph Lamed. Okay, does that make sense? But similar to the way we divided, Samach Mem is the impure, Aleph Lamed is pure. The Ches of Nachash, the Ches is the impure, and the Nun and Shin are the pure side. This is what the Arizal writes. I don't understand this stuff, but it's Kabbalistic and it's pretty cool. I just want you, if you can picture this, the letters on the right side that you wrote on your paper, the Samach, the Mem, and the Ches all represent the impure, and Aleph, Lamed, Shin, and Nun represents the purity. You got that? Mark, you got that? I want to make sure, because I see you writing it. I want to make sure.
Okay, get this. Wait a minute. Samach Mem, what was that?
Samach Mem is impure.
Impure. Okay, impure, right.
And no. Aleph Lamed is pure.
Pure, right.
Okay. And again, in the word nachash for snake, the ches is impurity. And the shin and nun is purity.
What's the importance about it, Rabbi?
I'm about to show you.
I'm always saying okay.
The Torah tells us that the people in the time of the flood had become so immoral, had become so degenerate, there was nothing left but Hamas. You'll notice that the three letters on the impure side spell that word. The Ches, the Samach, and the Mem spell the word Hamas. There was nothing left but impurity. So what does God do? God tells Noah, I want you to build an ark that's going to be a safe haven of where purity can still exist amongst all the impurity. What are the four letters of purity? Aleph, Lamed, Shin, and Nun, right? Those are the four leftover letters. Those are the four dimensions of the ark, gentlemen. 300 is the Shin, Nun is 50, Lamed is 30, and Aleph is the top one. One cubit at the very top. This was the one pure spot left in the world because of the impurity that had penetrated all the way down into the earth, that it had to be destroyed because there was complete severing to any level of connection to purity. All that was left was Hamas, the letters Ches, Mem, and Samach. And therefore, Noah had to build an ark made of those four letters, Aleph, Lamed, Shin, and Nun. Ami, you see it now?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay. Why am I telling you this? Is because that's how the ultimate end, when it says that God, at the end of Chad Gadja, that God will come and slaughter the Malach HaMaves. How do you mean he's going to kill him? He's not physical. He's not going to get his neck severed. What it means is that God is going to separate his impure aspect from the what has kept him going all these years, that one little kernel of purity, the Aleph Lamed. He's going to separate it out, and all that will be left is the Samach and Mem, and he'll be left with nothing. That's what it means to shecht him. Okay. If you didn't follow this last piece, don't sweat it. What I want you to walk away with, gentlemen, seriously, I went way over here, probably way too high, but every now and then I got to show you that I earned my rabbinic degree. The idea I want to express to you is that the night of the Seder, just to review, the night of the Seder is the night of where Yitzchak gave the blessings to Jacob. That happened the night of the Seder. Now, obviously, the story of the Exodus hasn't happened yet, but it was that night on the calendar, the 15th of Nisan, is where Yaakov got those blessings. And everything that goes on at the Seder is connecting back to doing things to earn those blessings. We have the ability to attain the level of forgiveness and level of blessings that were given on that night many years ago. Every year at the Seder, we get to behave like the Kohen Gadol, the high priest in the Holy of Holies, to earn that forgiveness, to earn those blessings if we utilize it properly. That's the message I want you to walk away with. Again, and I'll give you this challenge. Go through your Haggadah, go through your Seder, and see if you can find other symbols or other parallels to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, because there are others. This is what the night offers us. It's not just a cool night that we can get together with family. It's not just cool, okay, it's a tradition. Understand how rich in tradition this history is. This ceremony of sitting down with our family and telling over the story of the Exodus year after year allows us to tap into that greatness that is packed in this night of the Seder. I'm sure I threw a lot at you, and I do apologize for that, but are there any questions that I could try to either clarify or answer?
What about... who's the one that gets tricked when they get married?
That's Jacob.
Okay, so when he tricked his dad to get the blessing, do you think Hashem said, well, I'm going to make you, since you tricked your dad, I'm going to trick you when you get married for the first wife?
Great, great question. And the commentators, Eddie, do talk about that. That's an excellent, excellent connection.
Because like you said, how it refers things in the Seder to all the other stuff that we do.
Well, excellent point. Excellent.
Rabbi, as a kol chami ra that we say when we get rid of our, is that Aramaic?
Yes.
Yeah. So that is, again, we're getting rid of
it's
the
not, chametz. It's not part of the Seder, but it makes sense because, again, where chametz represents that yetzer hara, right? We're making sure that we are ridding ourselves of everything, and we're, so to say, looking the satan, looking the Yetzer Hara right in the eye and saying, I'm going to win this. I'm going to get rid of every aspect of you in my life. That's why, perhaps that's why it's in Aramaic. The simple reason is because that's the language they spoke back then, and you have to know what you're saying for it to be effective. Now, which I recommend to everybody, when you do that and you get rid of your chametz and burn it, you should say it in English as well if you don't know Aramaic. You should. You really do need to know what it is you're saying. But I think that's perhaps the reason.
Sure. Thanks. Can we get together?
I heard a thing.
We were wondering if we can get together tomorrow night at 9 o'clock, because after 24 hours, when we think about this, we're going to have a lot of questions.
I'll tell you what. I'll put it in the chat. I'll put it in here. You can text me. You can email me. I mean, I'll be at a wedding tomorrow night, but I'm happy. I'm happy to go back on here. Here's my cell. And here's my email. I use it anytime, all the time. Some of you are good about it, but you're all welcome to use this. Text me, email me, any questions, concerns, anything. If you come up with any other, something that unique to your Seder this year, I'd love to hear about it. By all means.
All right. Thank you.
Oh, I heard this one. What about, they said that you should say when Elijah, that you should say,
Baruch Haba, welcome.
Well, because Elijah in the Bris Milah, they say that to welcome the child in, and then you're supposed to welcome Elijah coming in on when you open up the door. And they say you should say that before, because you're welcoming in. Welcoming at each time.
I never heard that before. That's interesting.
We do that. We've always done that.
That's interesting. I never heard that. Interesting. That's cool. Okay. All right. Have a wonderful, everybody. Have a Chag Kosher V'Sameach.